This week on Barbell Shrugged, we visit the Human Performance Labs at Cal State Fullerton to discuss the latest sports science with our longtime friend, Dr. Andy Galpin.
Hey, this is Rich Froning. You're listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Shaka, bro.
Welcome, everybody, to a very, very smart-looking episode of the Barbell Shrug podcast. I'm Chris Moore here. Doug Larson across the lab table from me in his very dirty lab coat.
Dr.
Larson. Doug Larson today. CTP behind camera number one and on mic for this episode.
Yep.
Charlotte, hello, dear, behind camera number two.
Should
for like the 800th time on this show, Barbell Shrugged OG, if there ever was one. Dr. Andy Galpin. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Andy Galpin. Yeah, you got an actual PhD and scientific credentials and whatnot. Andy, can you, before we get going, tell us where the hell we're at? Why are we wearing these fancy outfits and goggles on our head? What's going on, man?
So you are standing in my biochemistry and molecular exercise physiology lab.
Many big words.
Yeah. How long did it take you to learn how to say that?
You know, it was like
4 years of grad school.
My entire PhD thesis was on that lab name.
Oh, man. What would make me the smartest?
Yeah.
So what, what are you doing here?
So my lab is a part of the Center for Sport Performance.
Mm-hmm.
So our entire goal and mission is to figure out performance. So if it's not giving us an answer about actual exercise and human performance, we're not interested.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Center for Sport Performance, not the center for sick old animals or cells or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's about sport performance.
So ways to make ourselves look really cool and smart.
Yeah. I mean, here's our general idea. We want to use physiology, we want to use chemistry, we want to use science to figure out performance. Mm. We're not interested in doing the opposite. In fact, most labs like this in the world are going to be doing the opposite. So they're going to be using exercise to study chemistry or exercise to study physiology.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know about performance. So I want to know what makes you bigger, faster, stronger, and I want to figure it out from the inside. And that's really what we're doing. So we're a muscle-centered research facility. So we take biopsies. We're looking at performance things. Just from a perspective from inside the cell.
Yeah, do you want to break into like really what the basic scientific approach you're applying here and how you're testing ideas and new hypotheses and how you're putting the data into place to help people out?
Yeah, so we really have a gamut of laboratories in our entire center. So we've got the Human Performance Lab. All right, this is where we're going to measure force production, strength, vertical jump. All right, so we're doing all of the really performance-based things in there. The next sort of lab over is a little bit of science with a little bit of performance. So this is our exercise phys lab. We're going to be doing exercise performance type of stuff, but we're going to be adding in maybe blood work, collecting ventilation gases, things like that. So a little bit more sciencey.
A little more fancy.
Yeah, but still you're going to do a VO2 max test or you're going to cycle to exhaustion on an Aerodyne or something.
Yeah.
Over here is sort of the other end of the spectrum where we're doing all of our chemical analysis over here. We've got a million-dollar laser microscope a couple of floors below us. We're looking at muscle at the most detailed level possible. And again, the big picture here is trying to use all three of our laboratories. And our general approach to science is, let's do whatever we need to do to figure out performance. That's really where we're trying to go with everything.
So earlier,
sorry, I got to interrupt you.
Okay.
CTP's laughing his ass off. What, man? What do you see?
You're sweating up.
His
glasses are fogged up.
For scientific, ladies and gentlemen, for scientific effect, do you see that I'm wearing the lab coat and stupid goggles on my head that make me look like I'm going to look through some kind of microscope or maybe some mucus or body phlegm might spread?
You're fine.
I'm a fat guy in a lab coat that doesn't really fit all that much. I got these tight. Look, I'm bailing on those glasses. Go on, Dr. Andy Galpin.
So
making important decisions to shape humanity for the better. This guy's making fun of my sweatiness.
Sorry.
Oh, the same. Down in Dr. Lee Brown's lab, where the force plate was and all the machines were, like the performance oriented laboratory you're talking about. You guys had, I mean, probably literally hundreds of different studies that you guys have done just over the last couple of years. Which number one, that's a phenomenal amount of research studies to do in just a couple of years. That's ridiculous. But number two, like, do you have a couple of research studies from the last couple of years that you've published that have been like shocking or like everyone thinks that the outcome would be one way, but you know we actually showed that the results are totally opposite or anything like that are just like mind-blowing, myth-busting, that type of thing?
Yeah, boy, that's everything we do.
Oh, yeah?
We're basically the myth-busters here.
Just kidding. Sometimes we support what we think. A very quick example of that. This is a Lee Brown study. a handful of years ago. So he's interested in over-speed training or additional fast training. So
which is?
So if you want to get fast, right, you want to improve your running speed or your jumping, right? Mm-hmm. The best thing you can do is run fast. Right. Well, that's sort of the common
practice
idea. Or you say, okay, I want to get better at running fast, so I'm going to run with a little bit of resistance. Right. So your classic running with a bungee behind you or dragging
parachute.
A sled, squat jumps with a little bit of weight on your back, right, a little bit of resistance. And we've known actually there's quite a bit of research on that that suggests that's going to help. That does make you fast and jump. Well, he's interested in the other end of the spectrum, which is I want you to practice being faster than you already are, right? So a couple of examples he did in that lab. Number one is a classic baseball bat. So if you've ever played baseball or you've watched a baseball game.
Yeah, if you got drunk at the park and you watch guys play sports, you also observe this.
Right. You're going to see people, before they go up to bat, they're going to put a donut on their bat, which is adding extra weight. It's just like doing... Mm-hmm.
Not a real donut.
No.
it's a weighted piece of metal you slide on the bat to make it heavier,
make
right?
Make it heavier, right?
So calm down, everybody.
The idea being you get used to swinging the heavy thing, and you take that donut off, and now you're ready to hit a big donut because now the bat's going to feel so much lighter.
Right. So we know that is fairly effective. In fact, well, the donut isn't, but that type of training. So resistance training for speed and power would be effective. Well, he kind of came back and said, what if I, instead of swinging something heavy before I swing my bat, what if I swing something lighter than my bat?
It's kind of counterintuitive at first.
Yeah, so he had them swing wiffle ball bats, which are very, very light, a few ounces.
And what it looks less manly than swinging a big bat with the donuts on it,
right?
Admittedly.
So what he found actually is that their baseball bat velocity, their swing speed, was faster when they swung the wiffle ball bat first.
Wow, yeah.
Right, so we've done the vertical jump version of that.
So tell them what you had in your lab that allows people to jump higher, faster.
On top of our force plate is a big harness that goes overhead. It comes down, and you can attach this harness. You pull the string, it lifts you up in the air a little bit. It's kind of like jumping on a trampoline, almost. And so when you jump, you can jump way up in the air because you have like 30% less body mass. All right, and so it's over-speed training. It's jumping higher than you can normally jump. All the training studies and even all the acute studies he's done on that have almost all shown that's actually more effective than resistance jumping. So squat jumping or something like that.
So the I don't know if it's a fallacy or a bias or just your personal feelings when you swing something heavy like the baseball bat and then you swing the regular bat, it feels lighter, but that doesn't mean it's moving faster. That's like an implication almost. It's like, well, it feels lighter, so it must be moving faster.
Exactly,
but
it's
when
not.
when you actually study it and you measure the speed, that's not actually the case.
Correct.
Are you suggesting that how I feel, Doug, may not be true? my feelings might lie to me.
How you feel is true because it does feel lighter, but the implication from that feeling is that it moves faster, which isn't necessarily the case.
Right.
So another example that maybe you guys have tested this, maybe not, but if a boxer is getting ready for a boxing match, like instead of putting on heavier gloves and doing a lot of shadow boxing full speed, thinking like having the heavy gloves is going to make him, it might add some effect.
Oh,
it's helping more than likely, but maybe speed by punching with the heavier gloves, maybe he should just do bare knuckle and do very fast shadow boxing bare knuckle, and then that'll improve your speed instead of heavier gloves.
100%. So just to really clarify, we're not saying the resistance stuff doesn't work. What we're saying is this also works, and it, a lot of cases it's more effective.
Right. And the other
easy
thing,
to do. You could probably do this a lot and get better quick.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The other thing that I think people, they hear something like this, and then it becomes the ultimate you should never do that.
Right.
When you were only testing one thing.
Right.
You're saying swinging the bat with the donut on it doesn't make you swing it faster. That's all we're saying.
Yes.
We're not saying it has no effect on anything else. There's a million other variables you could measure. In the boxing example, like maybe having heavier gloves like gives you better stamina.
Sure.
Or, you know, because you're used to doing 5 or 10 or 12 or 30 or whatever, how many rounds you want to do with those heavy gloves. It gives you better stamina, better muscular endurance, better cardiovascular endurance or whatever, but it doesn't make you punch faster, as an example. But you're just talking about the one very specific thing. A lot of people get that wrong.
Yeah, and we're going to actually bring up some points in this later for some of the actual studies that we've done recently, and I'll highlight that point even more. But that's one of the major problems with the current or the past approach to science, and what we're trying to fix now in our sort of new approach, a new model of science, is to be very clear about those issues. So here's exactly what it means. Here's what it does not mean. So the old adage in sort of science is that sometimes not a difference or no findings are equally or more important than findings.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. So things like that, and being very clear about the implications of your study and what the implications are not is another important point.
That's a really interesting thing, though. Those things, finding something, not finding something, or disproving something, but probably those first, just those first two, finding something versus not finding something. If you find something, everyone wants to publish it. If you don't find something, it seems like people are like, well, that's not very interesting anymore, when it can be just as important.
That's a real problem in science, particularly when you get to the supplement game.
Mm-hmm.
So
supplement
if you look and do pick a cherry extract, all right? And okay, we're not.
What are the benefits of cherry extract, Andy? Should I take it? How many grams? Should I cycle on and off the cherry extract?
Right. So you can maybe go out and find five papers that show some positive benefit to cherry extract. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't mean you don't see the 100 that were studies that were done that did not that were not published that showed it didn't work. And so if I were to give you the entire breadth, if I said we did 105 studies, 100 showed it didn't work, 5 showed it did, you'd probably be like...
Change your outcome.
Right? But if all you see is the 5 that showed it did work, you're like, wow, every study shows it work. All right, and I'm not saying that about cherry. I just made those numbers up for cherry. I don't know what the numbers are. But that's a very important point of not published is a real problem. And that is a current dogma in science of if you have no difference or if you find nothing statistically, you're very likely to get rejected from publication.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem.
I feel like people don't understand even what science is. They think of science and they think of like all the stuff that's around us right now. They think of like chemistry stuff.
Neil deGrasse Tyson on HDTV. Science-y. Saying shit that's crazy.
Right, but they don't really know what science is. Like in my mind, when I think of science, like I think it's just a process of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. It's just a process in my mind. Like how do you describe it?
Science is simply logic.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, I'll go all the way to the beginning to help paint this picture.
Of time?
Yes.
Wow,
close.
Geez. Comprehensive, Dr. Andy.
We're going to go back to Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my favorite of all time. I gave a keynote lecture a few years ago at NSCA National Conference.
The National Strength and Conditioning Association.
Yeah, and the talk was on supposed to be on muscle physiology, and I talked about Aristotle the entire time.
Mm.
And the basic idea was Aristotle is essentially given the credit for developing what we now know as logic. The scientific process is simply logic. All right, so you develop an idea, you question, don't know an answer to something, you do some kind of test, you interpret your result, you retest, and then you adjust your thesis, your hypothesis, right? Well, the problem with that now, in fact, this has happened in the last couple of decades. That last critical step of retest is eliminated. We can't do it anymore.
You're saying things are piling up, lots of results and evidence coming on the internet at all times. There's a lot of results piling up and not a filtering through to see what the best of these are?
No, not necessarily. What I really mean is whenever we come out with the publication, it's not vetted entirely. So, for example, if I did one study on 5 people and I found a result, 40 years ago, you'd have to repeat that in a different group of people, a different group of people, a different group of people. You'd have
confirm to confirm your results.
Confirm your results. And then when you publish it, you have a really good idea that what you found is indeed happening.
Mm.
Well, now it's gone so far in the other direction, the most common reason your paper gets rejected from publication is because it's not new enough. It's novel enough.
Mm.
Someone already did that study. Yeah, I want to confirm it. I want to do it in a different group with a different rest interval or with a different new supplement.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that. Not new enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is the importance of every individual study has gotten watered down.
And do you think also the impact of these studies and these journals is getting a little watered down by the fact that they're looking maybe for getting more people just to pick it up and read it and be engaged like it was a magazine versus a trusted source of knowledge featuring some studies that are duplication to make sure we know where people just being pressured into that?
The pressure on our end as scientists is you need to publish. I mean, you mentioned we got all these publications, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's publish or perish, right?
Publish or perish, right? And so for me to go back and collect more data, why would I do that if I'm not being forced to by the peer review process? If someone will take me with 15 people, I'm not going to go collect 30. Why? I get one publication and it's double the work.
Right. No incentive for you to do that. It's more work and no extra payoff.
Right. Exactly. No extra payoff. And in fact, it's not even not extra payoff. It's worse because then when I go up for review at the end of the year, they're going to be like, you only did this many papers. You should have done more.
Mm.
And so we're not only de-incentivized, we're punished for doing less work, even if it's a higher quality.
All right. Who do we blame?
The man.
Right.
The man in the system.
Yeah. So the problem is what that means for a practitioner is when you see a research study or you hear about a paper, you have to think a lot harder about the implications of it. It doesn't mean what it used to mean. Mm-hmm. And so science is really changing before our
eyes.
Chaos
in the brickyard, Andy.
It's chaos in the brickyard.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, people are probably hearing that, and they're like, is he saying that science is total bullshit? Like, all these studies don't mean anything? Like, what are you saying?
No, what I'm really saying is you have to be very careful about the detail of the paper. Mm-hmm. So if it's not very directed towards what you're interested in, mm-hmm. you don't disregard it. Mm-hmm. But you don't make it, as you said earlier, it's not meant the end-all, be-all. Mm-hmm. All right, so we found one study to support your idea, therefore that's proved. We can't prove anything in science. I mean, that's the old adage of science, is there's no such thing as prove or disprove.
Yeah, well, like
those words don't exist in science.
Being in a laboratory reminds me that this is a place where ideas and creative insights, things you observe in a gym, hunches you get, can be tested. And then the outcomes of this, the more outcomes we get that we can trust and that are veritable and good, we're getting a better, like a sharpening image of reality.
Yeah, so the way that I like to actually think about it is science is logic, right? And logic was never intended to be the end result. Logic is where you start. So here's what we think happens most of the time in most people. Mm-hmm. Now, you need to use your own personal experience. You need to use experience from other elite sources or experienced folks. And then you modify, tweak, maybe even disregard what you started with. But we need to start with science. That's where your initial thing is, because this is what's most likely to work for most people most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then you will, without a doubt, find some people who it works fantastic for. It doesn't work at all for. And you use your experience, your creativity, and you use other experience of people good in the field, mm-hmm. and you modify from there. So it's just a starting place.
Right. I've done two or three presentations talking about supplementation. And one of the things that I always start with is I show these two different graphs where the first one is like a scatter plot of all the people that say they – There's just made up graphs that I just did for the purpose of explaining the concept. But there's a graph where it shows there's 20 people. Here's the results of their study. Say they took creatine. They took one group took it consistently for 6 weeks. Another group didn't. They took a placebo or whatever. And then the creatine group, if you look at it, maybe some people they put 30 pounds on the back squat. Some people put 20, and some people didn't do anything. They didn't gain at all. Some people actually they lost. You know, they're 5 pounds weaker on their back squat at the end of 6 weeks. And if you average it out,
right?
You know, if you average it out, then each person gains 5 pounds. But to your point, like, the average doesn't really matter. Like, for you as an individual, you need to look at that graph and say, you know, does it work for some people? Should I try it or not?
Yes.
If it doesn't work for everybody, well, okay, that's one thing. But if it works really well for some people, kind of good for some other people, and doesn't work at all for other people, well, maybe it's worth a shot, barring no side effects and whatnot.
You want to go ahead, Andy? We talked about post-activation potentiation. You want to go ahead and talk about breathing, because that was one of the key outcomes that was the power of individual results, right?
For the respiratory warm-ups. So Doug's point is 100% right. The way that science works is you publish based on average. So I collected 20 people, all right, and the average result was 10% better, worse, and different. But you're going to have people way up, way low. Mm-hmm. And so you run statistical analysis, right, and that's supposed to determine whether or not that one person up here or down there was fluke or was it luck.
Like, what are the odds that what she observed is a real thing?
Right. And so for decades, that's how science has worked. P.005. That's all you care about, right?
Especially if you were taking stats in college, you remember that fucking number.
Yeah, that's all that it doesn't, you don't need to know what it means. Point is, like, we have this magical, in fact, I'd rather you don't, because that's how arbitrary it is. Mm-hmm. It's this weird number
everyone just paused
settled
the video
on.
And said, what is P.005?
Right?
We're back.
Arbitrary number, right? Well, what you do then, you take your average and you say, okay, that was higher or lower than our arbitrary number. Therefore, it worked or it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But if you peel back the layers and look at, well, for a third of the people that had this huge input and a third it didn't and a third it was there, you can't do that in science. You're going to get trashed for it. You're going to get buried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as I said before we started the show, when you're coaching, you don't coach an average of 20.
Not the mean.
You coach one person. So if your one person is way down or way up, that's really, really important to you. Mm-hmm. So you have to take that into consideration. So the respiratory warm-up is a classic example of that, where we just completed a study using a little device called an O2 trainer, Boss Rutten's device, right? Where you essentially looked at doing this respiratory warm-up before a maximal effort cycling bid. So this horrible, horrible cycling exercise. and we put people that had to do it four times.
So they're breathing through something that's restricting their airflow, so they have to suck in harder. And then by doing that, sucking in and breathing out, sucking and breathing out against resistance, then you put them on an Airdyne or just some type of a cycle to go through some type of workout, and then you're testing what in that case?
So you're not using the mouthpiece during the exercise. Mm-hmm. It's just a way to warm up your breathing muscles. Mm-hmm. So just like you would warm up your curls at a light weight before you did heavy ones, mm-hmm. like anyone listening to this does curls.
Sorry. No, be careful. Curls is a very controversial training topic in this community. Yeah.
So same thing. You
wanna, get it.
You want to warm up the respiratory muscles, and then mm-hmm. you have a little bit of a break, and then you cycle to exhaustion. Mm-hmm. All right, so how far can you go before you're done, mm-hmm. right, before you stop? So every single person had to do it with no respiratory warm-up, either a really hard respiratory warm-up, mm-hmm. a kind of hard one, or a kind of easy one. Mm-hmm. At the end, the average result was that the respiratory warm-up did absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm. Throw that study out, doctor.
Right.
That shit ain't getting you tender. Throw shit out.
Right? Okay. Well, when we looked at the individual data,
yeah.
we saw something like, I can't remember the numbers, but 10 of the 11 people saw a 20% or higher bump in performance in one of the three warm-ups. Mm. And wow. So this is huge, right?
It's a huge effect. Yeah.
Huge effect. And so what I need to do is have you run through each one, figure out which one you respond best right. to, and most likely, 10 out of 11 chance, you're going to have a huge response to one of
the
three.
What was like the highest percentage of benefit you observed?
Probably like 38.
So a 38% increase in your ability to cycle to the death point.
Like
so,
you cycled 38% longer?
Correct.
That's huge.
That's an enormous number.
Yeah, and we're talking...
Is it trained or untrained or just college students?
No, they were people who were trained in high-intensity interval training of different varieties.
Mm-hmm. So some of them were runners, some of them were cyclists, some of them were MMA fighters, some of them were wrestlers, or no, what do you mean?
They were all people who worked out in a CrossFit gym or a CrossFit-esque gym. Okay. Something like that. They did CrossFit style programming, intervals a lot, circuits, some strength, mm-hmm. something like that. And so the cycling test took about 5 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. So it's brutal. It's not an hour long cycle to exhaustion. It's a 5 minute one. And so instead of going 5 minutes, they now went 6.5 or something enormous like that. Huge, mm-hmm. huge bumps. Mm-hmm. Now, what's also interesting is some of them saw huge decrements. So say 5 minutes was normal. One of the warm-up trials, they went 7 minutes, and one of the warm-up trials, they went 3. Mm. And so finding what worked for them was really important, but also finding, hey, this might crush you too.
Yeah, it's like playing with fire.
So it seems like right. some people are getting potentiated in the breathing musculature, and some people are maybe getting fatigued.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. So the warm-up protocols that were too difficult for some of them fatigued their respiratory muscles. Mm. So they gassed really quick when they started the exercise bout. And so this is just a very quick example of what you mentioned earlier where if I would have just looked at the group average, mm-hmm. I would have been like, oh, no, this doesn't work. Move on. Respiratory warm-up. Not important. It's all bolt.
Right. But even though it worked for everybody, basically.
Almost everyone saw some benefit somewhere. Now, I'm probably going to get hammered for it, and it might not get published. Mm-hmm. But that's the type of stuff we're trying to do because we think that that's important. Mm-hmm. And you are seeing a change in culture and science. Mm-hmm. There are other people looking at other means outside of simply was it significant or not. Mm-hmm. There are other approaches that people are getting more sophisticated with. And I think that the people who are doing this type of research that are real practitioners are moving more towards a model of what I just described of let's really dive because maybe the individual responses are more important than we appreciated. And we can't just mm-hmm. throw these things into a group average. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're doing a disservice and we're missing a lot of things.
Yeah. I mean, the classic example is if you're an Olympic sprinter and losing the gold medal is 0.01 seconds, and you can get a 1% bump.
Right.
That means setting a world record.
Right.
Versus losing.
Right.
Like getting like no one knows who you are versus like national hero.
Right.
Like based on like yeah. like taking one thing that someone says doesn't work.
Right. And the opposite is true actually too, where we see all the time you'll see maybe a 10 or 12% bump in something that's actually not practically significant.
Right.
So it's statistically important, sure, 10%, but in the terms of when application, it won't actually matter to your performance. Mm-hmm. So we see both ends of that spectrum. So it's really important we continue to have skilled coaches, practitioners, people who have done it, get into science because we now understand these performance issues where if you have folks that are just doing the science that haven't really done it before, we lose a lot of that. They don't appreciate this aspect of science. So.
Yeah, more and more people are getting into this field. Like this being offered at a university is probably only how many decades old?
Oh,
like 20 years old, 30 years?
It depends on how far you want to go back. Do we want to talk about
us the history.
You want to talk about the evolution of our field?
It all started with Aristotle.
Yeah. Or should we do it after...
I say, we need to take a break because when we get back, we have some delicious things to get into, like some newfangled ways scientifically to maybe optimize our gains or get a little better result from our training. Take a quick break. That's coming up. We're at the break, folks. Cheers. Oh. Stay tuned.
This is Tim Ferriss, and you are listening to Barbell Shrugged. For the video version, go to barbellshrugged.com.
Barbell Shrugged is brought to you by you. To learn more about how you can support the show, go to barbellshrugged.com and sign up for the newsletter.
Welcome back to this very science-y episode of the show, everybody. We have a few more really cool things to share science story-wise, but before we do that, Dr. Andy Galpin, you're going to tell us how this field of sports science and kinesiology is kind of rapidly experiencing some big change.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that, man.
I think it's really important that people, not scientists, understand what's actually happening in the field, especially young people in this field, young coaches, even if I don't even be young by age, but new in the field. There's things happening right in front of their eyes that I don't think they're necessarily aware of. So if we sort of track the history of the entire field of strength and conditioning, we'll call it, it really started in Stockholm, Sweden, at GIH, which is essentially the first fundamental starting of the study of movement. Right? It literally started with gymnastics. It evolved, so we're talking late 1800s, around the early turn of the century. It evolves kind of a big jump into the Harvard Fatigue Lab, right, which is in the early 1930s or so, where they started studying fatigue and human performance. And they weren't doing it so that they could make sports better, right, because sports weren't really necessarily popular then. They were doing it really for things like industry. Labor force, right? Why are people getting so tired? How can we help them recover better? And so we're trying to understand fatigue.
So cool. It's a building block stage first. The characteristics of human movement and then what makes people tired. Very logical steps so far.
That's a really interesting question in and of itself. Like, why do we get tired?
Yeah.
Like, why does that happen? That's a very interesting question.
But we still have no idea.
Yeah, a bit of a rabbit hole too, right?
Yeah, right. It was also for the war effort. So soldiers, I mean, we're still, if you look at World War I, we're still fighting with hundreds of thousands of people in a battlefields for the most part.
It shows how conditions influence the way of thinking too.
Right. Environmental physiology kicks in. What happens? Like a tired, thirsty, hot, this type of stuff. So you sort of move on from there. And then you have the conversion of Dr. Karpovic, or Karpovic, however you want to say it, which is the development of Bob Hoffman, York Barbell.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Where we have, okay, you shouldn't do all this heavy stuff. It's bad for your joints. It makes you unflexible, inflexible. I don't know, what's the word there? I don't know. One of them.
Well, immobile.
Makes
immobile.
You stiff. Unsupple.
Right? Unsupple.
Unsupple.
Right? And then you start demonstrating, wow, you can actually be really strong, really big, and be more athletic. Wow, this is actually good. And so what happens is you've got this conversion from lifting, fatiguing exercise is no longer not bad for you. Maybe it's actually okay. You know,
that realization was
in the
how long ago?
In the 1950s.
Okay-ish.
This is, I mean, Bob Hoffman, York Barbell, these are the ones really pushing forward where you had these, it turns out to be researchers and scientists who were saying, yeah, this is bad for you. You shouldn't.
Almost taboo to lift weights because that would slow you down.
It's highly taboo.
It would muscle bind you and make you very unathletic, prone to injury.
Yeah,
whatever.
And you have these...
Smoking was good.
And certainly some percentage of the world still believes that stuff. It's still persisting with people from that generation.
Especially
but,
that it slows you down or something.
Right.
They're just scared they're going to lose their girlfriends. That's what's happening.
Right.
I know it is.
And so you have with these people are developing these barbell exercises and big complex movements, we start realizing, oh my gosh, they can do standing backflips with 30-pound dumbbells in their hands. Their performance is better.
Who can't?
Right?
I mean, come on. And get all the chicks.
So you have this next transition, right, where it's, okay, maybe this stuff's not too bad for you. And the next big switch is what I like to call the Arnold Schwarzenegger effect. Right? Pumping iron comes out. Bodybuilding starts being in the entire...
popularization wave of this stuff.
Yeah, fitness is, and aesthetics is really the biggest transition, where not only is it okay for you to lift, but now actually maybe you can look better. You can feel better about yourself. You can have the body you always wanted.
Chicks.
That's still...
come everywhere, all the time.
Right. It's kind of what I call the...
Arnold was.
The bro, the bro area.
Now.
Right. It's the evolution of bro science, where it's like, let's take this highly scientific approach to weight training and weightlifting and exercising so that we can get as huge as possible, as fast as possible. Right? And so it's a really... it's the first time we've really started developing science for the purpose of aesthetic, for the purpose of, I want to look better, work out better, I want more results. Prior to then, it was about these other... classic physiology issues. We're cruising along good, and we still have that age is still alive right now. If you look at media, magazines, it's women, right? here's how to get bigger butts, smaller stomachs, mm-hmm. bigger tits. Wait, no.
And then the guy, yeah.
I'm like, there's an exercise for that? Teach me.
And for guys, right?
Big and the guys, it's the abs. Same fucking bodybuilding routine reprinted every magazine from now to the end of time. Four sets of 10, everything you see here, and not very progressive.
Right.
All the time.
And so what's actually happening right now is you're in the middle of the next big transition. Right, and that big transition is sort of multifaceted, and or I should say bifaceted. In fact, where it's shifting in the direction of we're now starting to realize the major health implications. Mm. Not only is it not bad for you like we used to think, okay, you can get looking good, but oh my gosh, here are the health implications of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Right, here are the health implications of interval training.
Mm-hmm.
Right, here are the cardiovascular benefits of high intensity exercise. Wow, and it is completely transformed what's happening at the medical level, at the healthcare level, because we're realizing, man, maybe we should have been doing all this really hard training all along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talked a little about the last show, like healthier muscle being the foundation of healthier everything, better insulin function, better communication between muscles and organs. Basically, everything that can function better, it will function better if the muscle's strong and healthy.
Yeah, one of the healthiest things you can do for yourself is to have a lot of muscle mass and have very little fat.
Right.
Like, there's very few people that have a lot of muscle mass and very low body fat percentage that are not healthy.
And you're not talking about like freak, crazy.
No.
Insane,
people who achieve it via natural means, training, just, and healthy lifestyle, not like massive amounts of steroids to make the muscle appear.
Right. No. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that was clear for the audience.
We're not talking about a 21-year-old guy, you know, going from 10% body fat to 9% body fat. Right. We're talking about just being in a reasonable health for your age and your development area.
Yeah, if your body fat percentage is in the teens for guys, like maybe high teens, low 20s for ladies. Yeah. That's pretty lean for both genders. And then if you have a decent amount of muscle mass, where you look normal, you look athletic, you look like a, you know, between a college soccer player and a college football player, like that type of athletic build. I'm not talking about being an enormous bodybuilder and being just ripped to shreds, where like all your veins are sticking out or anything like that. But you know, people that have a good amount of muscle mass and a very low body fat percentage, they tend to be very, very healthy.
Right.
People that are super overweight, all of a sudden they're not healthy. They got all kinds of diseases that come with the disease of being overweight.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And so, with that, you've got a decent level of physical performance. My prediction, and I've been telling my students this, the end outcome of a degree in our field is going to be completely different in a decade. I'm predicting right now you're going to be hiring strength and conditioning coaches in hospitals. Right, you're going to be hiring them.
Word.
You're going to be getting insurance is going to start covering these types of things. It's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to happen very, very soon. The entire industry will be different 10 years from now. The profession will be completely different in a decade now.
There's just no way to disregard the treatment weight, the sheer effect that a cheap – you can do this anywhere. You can have a few weights, get stronger, and really decimate these huge trends towards disease and metabolic syndrome and cancers and everything else.
Yeah, and so to establish that pedigree of importance, right, so you're professionalizing the profession, right? It's getting listed and regarded in higher esteem. The second part of what I said earlier, and I said it was kind of two parts, is the level of sophistication of the research in the field. It is growing leaps and bounds, where you have labs like mine where it's fairly unique. You don't have people that have the practical background that I have that have a lab like this.
Mm-hmm.
I have my students in here. You can see them up the wall. We've got more than 15 or so students who have been in here. They're running chemistry and molecular biology experiments, and they never had a chemistry class.
Oh, yeah.
They're strength coaches. They're working, so they'll leave an elite training center. Right, there's one in Anaheim. A lot of them work out here. Stars, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
They're training NBA players, NFL players. They walk over here, run some chemistry experiments, go back to class, then go back and work and train a football player.
And unfortunately, it seems a little bit taboo because people go, "Well, these kids have certain prerequisites and this kind of other." But then again, you're ruining this sort of crossroads effect where all the magic in any area of studies where ideas and personalities of people with different backgrounds are going to mix as they're working on a topic.
Yeah,
right?
Like you said earlier, you know, we're not a bunch of. I don't have a 4.0 GPA. I barely passed one chemistry class in my life, and I run a biochemistry laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
All my students are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not you're not like, well, my gosh, science, like you said earlier. It's not like, I'm just a strength coach trying to figure out strength answers.
Yeah, it's more like on-the-job training. It's like you're learning the pieces you need to know, and you can do those things. You didn't have to take 10 chemistry classes and learn total generic chemistry that you're never going to use.
Right.
You just came in and you learned the pieces that are important and you fucking disregard all the pieces that you're never, ever, ever going to use.
Right. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love it when I get students who have had molecular biology class and genetics class. It's super helpful.
Yeah.
Because they, like, I don't have to spend as much time training them about things that kill them. in this lab, which is good. They have some basic skill.
Don't drink the formaldehyde.
Yeah.
Hydrochloric acid. Down on Bordeaux.
Yeah.
That doesn't go on your face.
Yeah. The bottle of ATP I have, don't eat it.
Yeah. It's not a good thing to eat.
Please don't drink that. Right. So it's really a big transition where you're going to see a lot more research that is this combination of strength and molecular. In fact, the only way you're going to answer the questions we're interested in is to start doing that type of research. And we're pretty unique in the fact that we're doing that. Mm. And we're getting some really awesome practical answers by studying this level of physiology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, speaking of the practical answers, Andy, one of the other scientific topics we're going to bring up is heart rate and what you're learning recently with some of your evidence.
Just as a quick example of what we talked about a little bit earlier in terms of how you use science, I was telling Doug that a couple of nights ago, Natasha and I did some intervals on the Aerodyne. Mm. So 10-minute, we did 10.
It's a couple's date. It's a romantic evening.
Yeah, right? What do they say? Like exercise together.
Makes everything to train together, stay together.
Makes everything hot. Am I right, champ?
I just get yelled at the whole time. It's awful. We're not good training partners. But we did 1-minute intervals on the Aerodyne, as hard as you can. 10 rounds, 1 minute on, 1 minute off.
Mm, brutal.
Brutal, right? And I never wear a heart rate monitor, but I wore one to sort of show a point.
Mm.
I had an average heart rate of 195 beats per minute for the 10 trials.
Mm.
Got up to like 208.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you know what heart rate numbers mean, I just broke, like, apparently I'm 12 years old. Right? So if you don't know what that joke means, how you calculate your max heart rate is supposed to be 220. Minus your age,
mm-hmm.
right? So technically,
they test you on an exercise physiology class on your exam. Write that formula down.
Right. Yeah, that's your number, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what it's clearly showing is I'm not particularly fit. I'm not like super mentally tough, and I just passed. Like, that's not how heart rate works.
Mm-hmm.
Heart rate work is some of the best in conditioning endurance athletes I've ever been around have a max heart rate of like 175.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm certainly not more fit than they are, but the point I'm getting at is that number, that equation, which is so well documented in science, most high schoolers know that number.
Mm.
It didn't work for me. That doesn't fit my physiology. My max heart rate's more like 212. I've been to 212 dozens of times, more. So some folks might be at 170.
Mm-hmm.
So 220 is your starting point, but you can deviate massively from that number. And that's just a very basic example of the fact that the interpersonal and intrapersonal differences are huge in science.
It's like looking in an anatomy book and you're like, wow, the human brain weighs 10 pounds.
Right.
What does that mean? It's like saying like the human foot is 8 inches long. It's like, well, maybe for somebody, but right. Someone else's foot is twice that long. Like,
right.
It doesn't really mean anything. So the heart rate thing for you, 220 minus your age, like it should be, 188 or whatever it's supposed to be. But there's a standard deviation both ways. Like for some people, it might be way less than that. Some people might be way more than that. So to your point from earlier, it's not about the average. It's about the individual. And it's everything, not just in science, but everything in the whole fucking world right now is leaning towards becoming more and more and more individualized. And science is chasing that motif, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
The heart rate facts is a very convenient thing to keep in mind if you're a student in school getting very, very frustrated over the rote, repetitive memorization of shit. And you think that that's where your future lies and be able to spit back out facts versus just taking the time to understand what is the real core of why heart rate going up and down matters so
much. And there's an important point actually sort of buried in that I'm certainly not telling you to not pay attention to these normal numbers, because if you do, you're a fool. You need to know 220 minus your age. That you should start there. If you don't know that, you're going to miss the ball a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off starting with the average and then figuring out if you're deviating. If you don't know that, if you disregard this, if you're like, well, if none of that's true for everyone, I'm just not going to learn any of it, the hell with it all. I'm just going to figure it out as I go. That is a terrible approach. You're going to make years of mistakes until you figure all these things out.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So do pay attention to these things, but you just interpret them with a little bit of a, instead of being like, oh, that's the fact, that's the answer, there we go, it's, okay, that's pretty good. Let me start there.
I think a good way of looking at it, especially now we're in a laboratory science school, I think you have to learn the basic rules of where you're playing and what you're doing. That's why school might not be perfect, but you learn how things have been done, and you see the landscape, and once you get that level of information, then you can decide, right, this looks weird. Let me put a little pressure on that and test that. Is that true for everybody?
You can't break the myth if you don't know the myth.
Yeah, learn the rules and break the rules.
Put that on a T-shirt.
Right? Don't break the myth.
Hashtag.
Right.
So heart rate, Andy, we also talked a little bit about gaining muscle mass, hypertrophy. What's new on the scene with getting hashtag gains?
Is that a 3D printed muscle in your pocket?
I don't know.
Maybe he's happy to see me.
People watching this going, what in the shit is in Dr. Andy's pocket? He's going to tell you.
Not quite yet, though.
Not quite yet. Teasing me. What is the purple thing? Go ahead, Andy.
So what I wanted to bring up here is the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a nice number of scientists out there trying to do the type of stuff where, you know, the comment I hear all the time is like, wow, these scientists, they don't understand application. Yes, we do. Some of us. And we like, no one, why doesn't anyone ever do this type of work? Well, we are. You're just not reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this work is
It's an
happening.
Awareness thing, right?
This practical, so the example I want to bring up, I've been fortunate to collaborate with a guy. He's Facebook famous in the world of fitness, Brad Schoenfeld. Out of New York. He's the hypertrophy guy, like world's guru on hypertrophy. He's a great guy. He focuses on studying.
He sounds huge.
He's tiny. He's tiny, actually.
Oh.
But he focuses only. He keeps a very focused research agenda. It is hypertrophy, and that's it,
mm-hmm.
basically, right? So we've been fortunate to collaborate with him a little bit where he's doing a bunch of different training studies looking at hypertrophy. So he'll do an 8 or 10 week training study.
Mm-hmm.
Two groups. One group will get 1 minute rest between their sets, and one will get 2 minutes.
Sure.
One will get 3 minutes. And he's just doing all these things where, for example, we're classically taught, if I want to hypertrophy, if I want to get gains, right, I should probably do somewhere between like 8 to 12 reps per set. Right, that's your classic textbook number.
Mm. 5 to 8 sets of that.
Right, 4 to 5.
Like 80%, maybe even a little heavier, maybe a little lighter.
Maybe a little lighter, right? Well, Brad challenges all that. And he says, okay, that's actually never really been established scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny to sound because we've been teaching this for decades.
Right.
If you ask
this is what people do, and it just keeps persisting.
If you ask,
it's not like it doesn't work, but we're saying, is it the best way?
Yeah, so Brad is challenging that. So he just did a couple of different studies where he finished and he looked at rep range. And he showed impressive gains in hypertrophy in that 8 to 12 rep range, but he also showed it all the way out to like 25 to 30 reps.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, see, that's what people would assume is, no, you just get endurance effects from doing too many reps. Anything over 10, no,
right.
You won't get stronger.
Where mm-hmm. Here's the misinterpretation of it. He's not saying 8 to 12 is the same as 25. What he's simply saying is they both do work. Now, the 8 to 12 group or so was stronger at the end than the 25 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
So a misinterpretation of science is, they both work the same.
Right.
No, they both work the same for hypertrophy, but one of them also added these massive gains in strength.
Right. Hypertrophy means bigger muscles.
Bigger muscle, right? Getting mm-hmm. bigger muscles. So what he will say is his interpretation of the data is different than how people interpret his own, which is always how it works, right?
Yeah.
Like every time someone interprets my research, I'm like, no.
It's like
somebody, that is not what I said.
It's like when you hear a song, you say, oh, here's what that meant by writing the lyrics. And the guy who writes the song goes, no, man, nothing like that. listening to the same fucking song.
Right? And so what he says is you should spend the bulk of your training in that optimal 8 to 12 range, but then you need to also include out to 25 and include down to 5. And so he's just showing support for working across the spectrum. He's done the same thing for rest intervals. So if I do a set of 10, do I wait a minute, 2 minutes? Same thing. Most of your benefit comes with what we teach as a textbook, but you need to train over the spectrum.
Mm.
We've done the same thing in terms of, I love the question of, I want to get powerful.
Mm-hmm.
How heavy should I lift? Mm-hmm. If I lift really heavy, it's too slow, right?
Yeah.
If I lift really light, there's not enough mass for it to be powerful. Mm. And so the number coaches will throw out is like, 30%. It's a little bit of mass, right? But it's fast enough to go fast.
True. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the collective data suggests, that's good, but you got to train the whole spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You need to do some real heavy stuff. You need to do some real light stuff. Optimal power is achieved across the entire spectrum. So it's just evidence like that where there is this practical research happening. There's another guy in Florida who's doing a lot of the same type of things in elite bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're trying to answer, how's it different from young, old resistance training?
Sure.
Now, what's it look like at the top end of the spectrum? So this is happening. There are some of us out there, and if I could say one thing to anyone listening, we need more people like that. We need more people who really understand practical, because Brad actually started for like 15 years, he was a personal trainer. He got his PhD like 20 years after he graduated college.
It's mm-hmm. really refreshing to hear stories like that.
Right?
People assume like, I did some personal training. I can't go back and pursue an interest mm-hmm. like going to school, learning some science, learning how my muscles are actually working now that I know the application side.
Right. Most mm-hmm. of us are not scientists that learned application. Most of us are appliers, applicators.
Applicators.
Human applicators.
Practitioners.
Practitioners.
That mm-hmm. learned research because we wanted answers. So that is growing in science. We need more,
mm-hmm.
but it's getting there. The philosophy of attacking physiology from the perspective of the elite is a pretty new phenomenon, and there's only a few of us doing it.
Yeah, most of the sciencey research and or developments from a lab like this went towards more like the medical system where people
healthcare.
Are sick and they're trying to get better. There's more of a, you know, there's more pain, like quite literally, like emotional, physical, and otherwise, in that situation, which tends to make people very, very motivated to get out of that pain. So kind of most of the efforts went towards the medical world first, but now people are really starting to take all those same practices and apply it towards people that are their kind of baseline normal, and they want to be as healthy as possible versus being sick, trying to get back to normal.
Yeah. I mean, the general philosophy of our lab is if we want to figure out how muscle or the body is supposed to function, instead of looking at a normal population, which generally in research, normal population means 18 to 25-year-old male who's recreationally active, whatever that means, right? And what we now realize
means you're a college kid because that's the only pool you have to pull from?
Right.
That's what the lab is?
Right. That's
condoms.
The easiest subjects to get? What?
Condoms.
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 Absolutely.
Recreational
user.
Gotcha. Mm. And what we're now sort of, my philosophy is that's actually, to me, closer to the end, not the spectrum of normal. That's closer to the spectrum of sick. We shouldn't be taking people who are basically physically active and can be considering that the gold standard. Mm. We should be taking it the other approach, which is let's look at the elite athletes in the world. Let's figure out what they look like because that's where we're supposed to be. We're not trying to just get you back to not sick. Mm-hmm. We want you to be performing in terms of life performance, health performance, at the level of these elite athletes. So our contention is if we figure out what we're supposed to look like, then we can start getting closer to there. But if we don't know what we're supposed to look like, we don't know what we're going after.
I do like the idea of making the standards more stringent. Like anytime you raise someone's expectations, they always gravitate towards those expectations. Anytime you lower the expectations, people just... they kind of regress to those expectations.
Absolutely.
If the recommended amount of exercise from Surgeon General, whoever recommends it, is 3 days a week for 20 minutes at a time, and they're like, you know, go for a walk around the block, then that becomes the standard. Everyone thinks
right.
like they're doing a good job if they do anywhere even close to that. Like, I think we'd have a much better time, or not much better time, but a much better outcome, rather, if we said that the standards were 5 days a week for an hour or something like that. And then I could attack that argument from a million different directions and make a case for either side, definitely. But in general, I think having higher expectations is a good thing, especially if, we're talking on the individual level.
Right. Now, we'll sort of tease it back to the last episode I was on. I think I mentioned the fact that VO2 max is one of our more significant predictors of how long you're going to live, your VO2 max. Mm-hmm. So a classic example of what you just mentioned is...
What is VO2 max for everybody who didn't watch it?
So that's sort of... it's the maximum amount of oxygen you can consume, but it's essentially how your maximal fitness. So maximum heart rate, it's very similar to that. So your maximal cardiovascular function. Mm-hmm. Sort of think of it like that. So the way we normally say it is, okay, what's an average VO2 max score for a college male? And we would usually throw out a number like, well, maybe the mid to high 30s, maybe 40s. Mm-hmm. Right? That's actually really low. So we say, no. Like, you to be healthy as a 25-year-old, you should be... Everyone, in fact, the guy I used to work with, Dave Kostel, one of the classic exercise physiologists, always told us, if you're under 60, you're not trained. Mm-hmm. So 60 was him, was, don't talk to me if you're under 60. Mm-hmm. But yet we say, oh, don't worry about it. Oh, you scored a 41? No, you're good. You're normal. That's actually pretty good. And so that bar is very, very...
Not good.
Right,
you
normal's not
yeah,
good.
Yeah, I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
A 40 for it.
I was like about to say what my score was until you were like, if you're under 60, you're untrained. I was like... maybe I shouldn't say it. I've only done it once, like a true VO2 max test, but that was when we were playing college football together, like 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
And I think I got a 57.
Oh, I'm sure you're much higher.
I'm not. No. But
well,
once I started fighting MMA,
I bet you
my score went up because I was in way better shape fighting MMA.
I was fit. Now I got this one number tells me otherwise. Everything I've learned to date is a lie.
I got a 50.
For a football player, that's a pretty normal number.
Yeah.
College football player.
I think 58 and a half a couple of years ago on a
Did
bike.
Did he beat you by a half? You said 58?
Whatever he said, plus half. That's what I got.
I actually think, if I remember correctly, you beat me by one.
I don't know.
Just that
or,
much
or
more
I beat
fit.
You by one.
Yeah,
I don't
that's probably the case. You're certainly farther down the conditioning spectrum than myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without a doubt. So we're learning a lot by studying this practical stuff, especially there are people doing this type of work. We're learning every day, and it's changing the way that we're training. They're changing the prescription a lot from what we thought, because we're doing all this really cool stuff because we have the scientific knowledge, and we're not being scared away, and we're demystifying science.
Speaking of demystification and knowledge, you want to tell people what the hell this thing is in your pocket?
I will on episode 2 of the series. I'm just kidding. Yeah, sure. So I told you we want to run the spectrum in our lab, right? Yeah. So human performance, a little bit of physiology, all the way down to the nuts and bolts. So what we do is actually the muscle biopsy. So we go in with the needle, we take a chunk of people's tissue, and we pull it out. And then
you
we
take
start
a chunk of someone's muscle from their leg, and you rip it out of their body.
Exactly.
Yes.
Basically
exactly.
What happens.
It's not basically. It's exactly
in the
what
name
happens.
Of science.
In the name of science.
Uh-huh. People volunteer for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We get paid like cafeteria money credits or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We got $50 one time, maybe.
Here's a free 6-pack of chicken nuggets from Chick-fil-A.
Sometimes we have a bunch of variety of protein bars we give them afterwards.
Quest bars, I'm all down.
No, that's too pricey.
Made out of cast biopsies.
We got the kind that got the sugar alcohol, give you the walking fart. Is that okay for your trouble?
Maybe if we did AIDS or diabetes research, we could have the funding to buy Quest bars, but we're lower than that.
You're holding in your hand. Also, use descriptives for the audio-only audience.
Right.
Yes, if you're listening to audio, by the way, you're totally missing out right now, just like the last
Andy's holding
episodes.
He's holding a pink shaft, basically.
Yeah, a pink shaft sort of with dots. So what we do is, we actually do all of our analysis at the single fiber level. Mm. So that's one muscle cell at a time. Skeletal muscle fibers in humans are extremely unique. In fact, I won't go into the detail now, but go back and look at the write-ups that myself and my colleague Jimmy Bagley did for The Daily.
Okay.
So it's on your website.
To
link to it. We talk a lot about the stuff we're doing here.
The new
so.
Science of muscle memory.
Right. So we'll talk more about. You can read more about it there. But what we're doing is we'll go through this piece of tissue. So we rip it out of the leg, and we go through with a tweezer, and we pull out one fiber at a time, and we do all of our analysis on those fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So a classic thing we would look at is we would take a biopsy of Chris's leg. And we would count how many of those fibers are fast twitch and how many of them are slow twitch.
Mm-hmm.
Like basic type of stuff like that. Well, we're starting to get more detail because we started getting athletes, and for us that was particularly MMA fighters, where we'd put them in our human performance lab and they'd blow the doors down in terms of their power and their strength.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would bring them into our conditioning stuff and they're blowing the doors down on that. And right in our classic.
That's another thing to challenge because you typically wouldn't expect both things to exist at the same time, happening in MMA and also in CrossFit's happening where people are very strong and very fit simultaneously and sort of breaking rules.
Right. And we're like, oh my gosh, textbook, you're not supposed to be able to do that. And so my question, I'm a muscle guy. And so I started thinking, like, why in the hell is it happening?
Mm-hmm.
So we take the biopsies of these really high level MMA and UFC fighters and we started looking at it at the single fiber level. So what we're doing is we're actually looking at how big the fiber is. And in human skeletal muscle, it's unlike anything else where normally most fibers in biology have one nucleus. The nucleus is what holds your DNA. It's what tells your cell to grow.
Command center of the cell.
Right, die. Well, human skeletal muscle has thousands of these nuclei in the fiber. Well, we started counting them. So we actually use a laser microscope. We make a 3D movie of individual muscle fibers.
Which is super cool.
We stain it for the actin and the myosin, which is what makes it contract.
These are basically the components that comprise a muscle cell, make it ratchet and contract and shorten and lengthen.
Right. And then we actually started staining it for those myonuclei. So those nuclei. So then what we did is we were literally leaving the laser microscope lab, which is below us, and I had this file on a flash drive, and I'm literally walking back to my office, and Jimmy said, hey, I just saw a sign that the library apparently has a 3D printer.
And oh, snap.
So we literally walk into the 3D printer, and I ask the guy, what kind of files do you use? And he tells me, and I'm like, really? It's the same file we have. I pull out my flash drive, and I'm like, can you print this? And he pops into his thing, and he's like, yeah, come back in an hour.
Man, I'm going to show off in front of all my colleagues when they see this fucking thing.
So what you're looking at is the result. So this is a single muscle fiber. In fact, this is actually my brother. This is a fiber. I biopsied my brother, took one of his fibers, I imaged it, and then I printed it in plaster.
That kind
of looks like a giant nerd rope.
Yeah.
Those things are delicious.
So we
thanks for the scientific comment, CTP.
You said you're going to give us some extra video, right?
Yeah.
Char Binks will
put it will
that
show
in
the
there.
Real thing edited in
yeah,
all
you
swiftly.
Can see the 3D movie. You can actually just check it out on my website, too. I don't know the link. Just Google it. You'll find
it's on your membership site. $9.99 per month. Look at it.
Yeah.
You'll find
you have
Dr.
to be 18
Andy's,
or older.
You might find his porn video from 20 years ago. You might find science. Who knows what you find?
I forgot you did
Dr.
that.
Andy Galpin.
So some of the interesting things about this is if you see the black sort of dots.
Yes.
If you're listening to audio, pause.
There are
the
black
video.
Dots.
Right.
For the audio.
Many, many.
These are the nuclei. And so what we're actually able to do is count how many nuclei you have. Now, Chris, as the astute former scientist and strength coach you are.
I was a former scientist.
If you have a bunch of nuclei, what's that matter?
I would think that there's a lot more communication and handling of information than otherwise would be going on.
Absolutely. So in terms of training, if I have more nuclei, I can do things like recover better. Right? Because I have more control center. I can do different types of training and get better responses because I have more regulation.
And a more coordinated effort to do these things that need to get done.
Exactly. Things are more efficient. Recovery happens faster. All this stuff. And so I wasn't really surprised when we started to find these MMA fighters just simply started having more of these myonuclei.
Than Casey does, your brother?
Yeah, yeah. Well.
Nothing.
He's right. Working on it. His brother's working on it.
Right. So was also, and it actually gets hyper detailed past this. Doug and I were talking about some of the stuff earlier, but even the shape of the nuclei, you can see some of them are circular, like that.
Sure, yeah.
Nice circle.
Some are long.
Right?
Some
of them
squiggly.
Are long. That all means something, right? The shape of them. We talked about the location. So this image doesn't show it, but you got to realize that some of these nuclei are on the outside, and the movie will show this well. Some of them are in the middle. What we know now is when the nuclei start going to the middle, the fiber is about to die. We don't know why that's happening, but we know that that's a relationship. Young, old, strength train, non-strength train, this is all different. So the actions are different in them. So what we're trying to do is figure out, again, what makes these elite-level athletes different. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see it at this single fiber, single cell level.
So the more nuclei are becoming present, you're observing that. And then also I think what's interesting is when these athletes have a period of detraining, they go away. Are you observing any kind of effect when they are going away, they're not training, they're getting a change, and they come back to training, what happens because of all these nuclei?
Let me bring out my model again. Okay, now, it's a classic idea of muscle memory. So if I were to do a gain phase, right, if I joined a six-month muscle challenge, right?
You should, because this jack is very loose on you.
Wow.
Yeah, come on.
Wow, you're in my lab.
I'm in your lab, I'm calling you gainsless.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Just joking, Andy. Come
so
on.
If you were to do a bunch of training, this fiber would get thicker. Okay, it gets bigger. Well, that's a problem because each one of these nuclei can only control so much. Are you guys worried about the thickness of my doll here?
It's just
production crew, come on. Keep it together.
Charlotte's giggling behind you.
It looks bad.
I love it when Charlotte giggles behind me. So each one of these nuclei can only control a certain amount of area. Analogy, if you were to start a company and you're expanding across the globe, you'd eventually have to open up new offices everywhere to control
everything. Get a bunch
everything.
Of new managers.
Right. Well, you do that, and that's what happens. And so your fiber gets bigger, thicker. The diameter goes out, and so you end up having satellite cells come in. Those get developed into new nuclei. Mm. Cool. You stop training. The fiber shrinks, goes back to the normal size. Well, the old theory would be that the nuclei then die.
Because that
would
be like a waste of resource. And
right. What we're now thinking is that they actually stay alive for quite some time, so that when you start training again, those are already in place, so it's easier for you to come back to that space.
Mm-hmm. So back to your business analogy. So if your company grew and expanded across the globe, you open more offices, more offices, more offices. You hire more managers, more managers, more managers. And then you downsize. You start laying off employees. But what you didn't do is you didn't sell all your buildings and you didn't fire your managers. You still have that core team. That way, if business picks back up, you have all that infrastructure in place and you can grow big again very quickly.
100%. You get rid of the interns. You get rid of the low-hanging ones. And then you downsize a little bit, but you keep the important players.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can bring the other ones back to bring you back
out. That's a super important point to make, is if you get hurt, you get something happen in your life where you're making good progress, and now progress stops because of circumstances in your life that aren't allowing you to train, aren't allowing you to recover what you want. If you have to take a break, or if you take a break on purpose after a few competitions, you need some rest, you can come back way quicker and better than you think. You won't like magically just lose all this progress. Sort of the infrastructure is there to help you come back fast and probably better than before if you have a reasonable training program, right?
Yeah, 100%. We have another study actually launching here really soon that I'm really excited about, where some folks, if you know much about this, you might be thinking, well, how much of that is actually pre-genetically determined versus how much of it did you get when you trained?
Sure.
So we were lucky. We're very fortunate. We have a set of identical monozygous twins. So exact same DNA.
Is it the Olsen twins?
No.
That'd be cool though, right?
Yeah. It would be cool, bro.
Right. So identical twins, same DNA. One of them has about 30 years of marathons, Ironmans, endurance events. The other one has never exercised.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm.
So we literally,
like the dream scenario.
Literally have the best design study you can imagine. Exact same starting DNA, 30 years of consistent training. We're going to bring him in. We're putting him through a whole physiological gamut of testing, biopsies, all this stuff included. We're going to figure out, essentially, we know that basically everything is trainable. The question is how much.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, if you're naturally born, say, for example, your genetics would give you a higher VO2 max than Chris, right? Mm. Well, we think currently VO2 max, you got about a 20 or so percent ability to change.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but we're going to know. We're going to find out exactly. Is it 20? Is it 15? Is it 80? If the trained twin has got a double VO2 max,
right,
train ability is a lot higher than we
and
think.
Those are the results that'll get you published on the front cover of fucking Nature magazine.
You know why it won't? Because we've got a subject size of one.
But as we've learned on this show, and that's not necessarily strength. A bad thing. It's very insightful to have meaningful evidence from a very small experiment size.
I'm very fortunate working here because I don't have a lot of that pressure we talked about earlier in terms of publication. So I'm really fortunate. Lee Brown, the director of the lab, is also, or director of his lab. He's not my boss, but we care about doing awesome shit. If that means more publications, cool, fine. If it doesn't, I don't care. I want an awesome answer. I like MMA. I like fighting. I like this stuff. I want that answer. If it means I get published, cool. If it means I don't care. I want to know the answer.
What advice would you give to the aspiring science students and aspiring coaches and athletes out there, and if they want to learn a little bit more about sciencey stuff, where would you even start?
Okay, so I'm actually going to go a little bit big picture here.
Go big picture.
And I'm going to force you to go back to episode 189, the one you did with Alex Macklin recently.
Okay.
Knowing versus learning?
What's it? Learning versus knowing.
No, knowing versus learning.
Okay, right. So here's what be a learner versus... Don't be a knower. So when you hear these things happen, when, for example, someone has an idea and they tell you this training program's great or this supplement's great or you should do this or foam roll or you shouldn't do this, I really encourage young coaches to step back and instead of being like, no, bro, I saw a paper show that didn't work. What you need to say is, wow, I wonder why they're doing that way. I wonder how it's working. So, in fact, ever since that that meeting we had where we had this talk, I've had an entire new approach where every time something happens in my life, the first thing I try to do is, okay, I immediately want to criticize something. I play a game where try to figure out as fast as you can a reason why that person did that.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's training stuff or whether it's something like, you know, I went down to the kitchen this morning and my brother didn't do his dishes, didn't clean his pan. My gut reaction was like, you motherfucker.
Every
How
day
could you inconvenience
you?
Me so much?
Right? And so instead of doing that, I go, okay, and this is a conscious act. I go, all right, try to envision some reasons why he may have done that. Turns out he did that because my bedroom doesn't have a door. It's in the loft, and the kitchen's kind of below. So for him to clean it, he was going to have to bang things around. This is 3:45 in the morning. So he didn't clean the dishes so that he wouldn't wake me up.
Convenient.
Had I yelled at him, I'd have felt like a giant asshole.
Right.
Right. And so the same thing happens with training, all this stuff. So when someone says, I'm doing this approach or I'm doing this movement, I like to do this variation. Instead of being like, no, dude, I saw on Technique Wad, you're an idiot. Don't do it that way. Try to go, I want to think of three different reasons why he might be doing it that way. The same thing when young coaches read science, right? This thing worked. This thing didn't work. Well, okay, maybe it worked, but try to think of another scenario when it may not work. So this may have worked for hypertrophy. I wonder what happened to strength? What happened to speed? What happened to recovery? What happened at this level? Getting lost in the conclusion of science can be traumatic. It can be a terrible approach. So my young coach, my advice to them, when you're in class, when you're listening to audio or podcasts, whenever you're doing, when you're in the gym, try to have that approach and really don't think about, is this working, yes or no? And just think about, I wonder why. Give me three reasons right now why someone might want to do that. Now, you can still disagree, but you've gained so much more perspective, and you won't sound stupid when you say something to somebody who's a scientist like, oh, this has been shown to not work. And I'm like, really? Because I could play that game all day.
Yeah, that's an amazing mindset to cultivate. And what about people who want to get in touch with Andy, learn more about what you're up to, come visit you, track you on social media? Where can they find you?
Yeah, email Chris at barbellshrug.com.
Oh, no!
I'm just kidding. The social media stuff, at Dr. Andy Galpin, so like doctor, but not spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
You can do there. Check out our lab. You'll have to just Google my name and Google our lab. It'll pop up, or you can
put a link in the show notes to how you could get a hold of Andy here at Cal State Fullerton.
On our Instagram page, every time we finish a study, it gets down there. Every time I find an interesting study, I throw it up on there. I will link as much as I can. I know the links don't work very well on Instagram. People always ask me to put it in my bio. I'm not putting all the links in my bio. Just Google the damn title. It comes up. So things like that.
And hopefully in the very near future, we are going to be, after many meetings and a whole lot of work, we are finally going to be getting Barbell University off the ground one of these days. We firmly believe that education for the science of exercise physiology and how that applies to real training is not as good as it should be. We can't find anyone that's doing it as well as we think it needs to be done. So we're taking that into our own hands, and we're going to be opening that probably not by the end of this year. Might do some pilot courses or something like that. But we're flying in a choice member of the team from Australia to live here in San Diego, who will be helping me and Andy run that that new university. So look out for barbelluniversity.com.
Barbell University. In fact, there's already some stuff up there. There'll be more coming.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk a lot about that, but it's really a couple of things I want to emphasize on Barbell University. It is a completely different change in content. So it is content driven in terms of you're not going to get the same information in your 4-year college degree that you're going to get in Barbell University, and it will not be delivered in the same fashion you've ever seen it delivered. So delivery and content will be completely different. I couldn't be more excited about that project. It's going
to
be awesome.
Yeah, we're going to push the evolution of what we know forward, right?
Well, it's sort of silly, but it's sort of actually like getting up with the times. We're finally catching up with what you should be
it's
getting
sort of
in a college
updating
degree.
The mechanism by which you can learn and get involved and be a part of it.
Actually, on that note, if someone wants to be involved with Barbell University, definitely reach out to us. We're looking for people that potentially might want to teach courses someday down the line, or that just think that's a fucking cool idea and you just want to be involved. Just connect with us. More likely, connect with Andy. Where should they reach out to you?
Andy at barbellshrugged.com.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's the best email.
I was hoping you were going to give your current university address.
You can do that too, but that inbox tends to get very thick very fast.
He ain't checking through there. People ask about midterms and my question about my grade, all this
stuff.
Now,
I believe my track record is 100% in Barbell Shrugged fan emails being returned.
Positive.
Damn. Returned. I have returned every single email I've got, which has been a lot. Some of them are very ridiculous, like, you know, I'm currently an engineer, but I want to change fields. What should I do?
Just tell me.
I don't know.
I got my pen and pad ready, man.
Be awesome.
But you answered.
I don't know. Yeah, I always answer.
You're the man.
Sounds like you know a lot about engineering.
Yeah,
you keep doing that.
Like I said, if you have those questions, email CTP at Bar.
Well, we're here to help.
Yeah.
I'll wrap it up there. Ladies and gentlemen, a very fun sciencey show. For more information, go to barbellshrug.com. Sign up for the newsletter. We'll keep you up to date on all cool things like Barbell University and the future shows we got coming out.
Yeah.
Also, go to iTunes, Stitcher, and whatnot. Wherever you listen to the show, leave us a positive comment if you think we deserve it. Of course we do. And hell, we'll see you next time, man. Cheers, everybody.